William Rushton, you probably don't know the name, and it wouldn't be surprising if you didn't know the name. William Rushton, one of the greatest biophysicists and vision researchers of the UK ever, just missed a Nobel Prize the year that Granit and Hartline got it, and he should have got it for work, because that was for work on the retina. He developed his techniques for retinal densitometry, for measuring the density of visual pigment in the eye on the basis of reflected light coming out. And just a really brilliant, brilliant scientist. Everybody knew Rushton. He was the great towering figure in vision research until he died, late 70s, something like that. And within two or three years, no one knew his name. He's completely disappeared. And it was so cruel. I remember talking to Horace about this, but he just said the field had moved on because techniques had been developed, micro densitometry and things for measuring pigment absorption in individual photoreceptors of fish and even humans and so on. And the field just raced ahead, dependent very much on the foundations that he'd laid, but you didn't need to cite him anymore. So he was lost. And that's tough, for someone who got close to a Nobel Prize.
All right, but let's actually get... let's just revisit that point that you were making there. The sense of science as this large enterprise that moves on remorselessly. And you were talking about what is one's individual contribution worth, what you have a sense of. I think you said your brick in the wall, isn't that right? How did you phrase that?
I think scientists have to come to terms. I mean, we're all sort of selfish creatures, and we'd like to think that particularly if you put a lot of effort into what we do, someone will remember it. And I think a lot of people, when they put finishing touches to their latest publication for science or in Nature or whatever it is, think that there you are, there's my kind of inheritance. That's what I'm going to leave for posterity. Have to recognize that there's very little memory for individual scientists. Yes, of course, we can all remember the great names, so Newton onwards, maybe a dozen or 20, or maybe in your case, 50 or 100 great scientists, compared with the tens of thousands of people who have contributed. They've put their brick of one size or another into the wall, but we've forgotten them. But that is the nature of science. It's quite true. I mean, we won't forget the Botticellis and the Michelangelos and so on and so on. The artists are remembered for their name because works are unique. Scientists aren't and perhaps shouldn't be remembered for their name because they're only contributing to a process of discovery of the nature of life. I mean, it's just out there. It doesn't belong to the individual scientists. I don't know if Crick and Watson hadn't published DNA when they did, we know that it would have been Wilkins or whatever within a year or two who would have had it anyway. It's inevitable because it's there to be discovered. It's a nice story of Wagner taking a year out between Siegfried and Goethe Dämmerung in the ring and doing whatever it was, Parsifal and Tristan or something, never being willing that someone might scoop him by doing Goethe Dämmerung before he got back to it. But scientists would have those kinds of concerns because life is just there, the universe, nature is just there to be discovered, and scientists just do the discovering. So we put our brick in the wall, and we shouldn't have hopes too high about being remembered as individuals.
Inevitable question, what do you think you'll be remembered for?
Well, probably nothing, but I'd like to think that people would still recognize that I contributed to science, as well as to a very interesting period in the development of the interplay between science, society, and government. Being remembered, it's not that important. It's the legacy in terms of how life is lived that people should really be concerned about. So I hope I put a big little brick in the wall, particularly in recognizing the importance of the capacity of our brains to change. I mean, it actually is our only hope. I mean, the fact that we have this organ that can change itself, that can go beyond the informational limits the boundaries of our own genetic code and become something that our genes couldn't ever have predicted, I think it's a remarkable thing, you know, and contributing a little bit of knowledge to how brains are plastic. I'm very proud of that. It's not important that my name should be remembered for that. It's science moving on. And of course, the range of evidence now, extraordinary examples of the way in which brains can change at every stage in life, not just early in life. It just marches on inexorably. It's brilliant.
Of the three daughters, one scientist or...?
Yes, yeah, one. Sarah's a scientist.
And the others are...?
The youngest one is a paediatric nurse, and the middle one is the only, I think still the only female computer games sort of project leader in Britain, sort of conceiving computer games.
And so they all have a somewhat link to the scientific world.
Yeah, I think they're all... No, that's good, actually. I mean, they all did, I think, biology A-level, at least. And they all have some knowledge, you know, inevitably through me, some knowledge of science and scientists, some understanding of it.
So you mentioned scientists, you mentioned artists on the one hand, this list that we could all go through. I mean, suppose, let's do the cocktail party conversation thing here. You can have a dinner party. Who would you like to have at your table?
Well, I tell you, the dinner party I remember best with... Francis Crick and James Watson and Richard Dawkins at the same dinner table, which was sort of fun. Who would I have? I tell you who I'd have. I'd have Francis Bacon and Francis Bacon. I refer, of course, to Francis Bacon, the originator of, you know, some would say the scientific method. Early 17th century writer, late 16th century, huge influence on Harvey and all, everything that followed Royal Society, the father of the Enlightenment in many ways, and his direct descendant, Francis Bacon, the painter, now dead, whom I knew quite well and had huge regard for. I think he's the most amazing artist. But both of them highly creative and original in very different ways. It would be great to see them talking to each other.
So now, I had no idea that there was a descendant there.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember seeing the younger, the more recent Francis Bacon at a place called Muriel's.
Well, sort of you mean the Colony Club?
The drinking club.
The Colony Club
in Soho. In Soho.
Yes, I went there too with him.
Very interesting, very interesting. Science being a process of you know, stumbling, falling, getting back up again, inventions, discoveries, competition, collaborations, and so on. On your individual trajectory through this, what's the biggest mistake that you ever made, and what did you learn from it? It doesn't have to be the science either, just your...
God, this looks terribly arrogant even to be hesitating about, because there could be several interpretations of that. Either I think I made no mistakes or I made so many that I can't pick an obvious one. I don't know, I suppose... Well, I sometimes wonder about whether the enthusiastic commitment to science communication limited what I could have done as a scientist. I'm pleased with what I did as a scientist. Very happy with the students that I taught and the impact that they're having now and so on. I mean, I'm very, you know, very satisfied with that. But still, you can't help reflecting. There are only so many hours in a day. And if you spend some of those hours doing something different from the thing you're primarily focused on, then it is bound to have some impact. Some benefits. I mean, I think I learned a huge amount from interactions with the media and with the public, with organisations opposed to, for instance, animal research and so on. And, I learned a lot from those interactions, some of which probably benefited my science. But, it's a simple equation, isn't it? If I'd been beavering away in the lab all the time, I would have got more done. So that's something to think about, if not regret.
All right, a shift in emphasis then, let's put it that way, rather than, than a giant mistake. And certainly there's a thing called neurotree, which you will well know, which shows one's intellectual antecedents and offspring. And so I assume there's an awful lot of offspring on your neurotree, so you must have had a lot of students go through there.
Yeah, a lot of wonderful students, who many of whom made their own mark in academic life, and a lot of great postdocs who've helped, because I have to say, to indulge in spare time activities like science communication means you've got to have, you know, deputies helping with the lab. You know, you can't just abandon the lab to go away and do a TV series or something without a very good person to help you run it. And I've been very fortunate in that respect.
Yeah, it's difficult to actually fathom how you could possibly have done all of these things. Do you get up very early or something, or work very late, or?
I should ask my wife and kids. I work too much, I think. But then, you know, many people do, don't they? Too many hours. So I hope I live a long time so I can do later on all those things I should have done.
What are you optimistic about?
I used to be optimistic about everything. Stupidly optimistic about everything. And I have to say some of the edges have been rubbed off that optimism. And as I said, I do, you know, I worry a lot. But then who doesn't about, the consequences of the present situation on this planet, on the tensions between people and the power of religion, the conflicts that drives, and then, you know, all the difficulties with the environment, with energies, and whether you believe in global warming or not, you know, we are going to run out of oil, so we have to have alternatives, and we haven't solved that yet. And food supply and resources of all kinds. I was reading the other day that unless we change our patterns pretty quickly, there won't be enough copper to go around. I mean, if you just project from increasing the population and the consumption of copper for all the things we use copper for, particularly in electronics, there just ain't going to be enough very soon. Well, there ain't going to be enough of anything. So I do worry a huge amount about, you know, resources and the impact we're having on our world.
Yeah. Are you still actually finding any time to actually do any science?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, no, I have a
what's your
small group and grants and things. I have two focuses. One, and very different, I don't work on animals anymore. I mean, I gave up my license, even Home Office license, when I went to the Medical Research Council to be chief executive. Because although I kept research going, I thought, well, it's just going to be impossible to run an animal lab. You need to be there, you know, so much of the time. So I gave up animal work. So all the work's now on humans. Completely different parts of the time scale. I work on the very earliest stages of the development of the human brain in the embryo. 4 weeks, 6, 7, 8 weeks post-fertilization. How the cerebral cortex is constructed, how cells differentiate and migrate, how axons grow, and so on. And that's building on, you know, 10 years of work on mice and rats to try to see whether the principles discovered in rodents really apply to the human brain. And then at the other end of the scale, I use these sort of new brain scanning methods, fMRI, and so on, to look at the organization of the adult brain, and particularly plasticity, how the brain can reorganize itself quite rapidly in response to the way in which it's used. I did some work, for instance, on blind people, on the way in which the visual parts of the brain get taken over, and the machinery, the visual parts of the brain get taken over for other functions. So I'm still very much interested in the plasticity of the brain, and particularly in the adult brain.
As you know, we also did a meeting called Brains Are Us, the Science of Educating, and we've talked about doing some sort of a panel together on this whole issue. So education is obviously a hugely important issue to you, the development of the educable organ, let's put it that way. Yeah. Right. So one of the things that we'd actually canvassed was the idea of possibly, and we're starting to have discussions about this, possibly of setting up what would the metrics be in the terms of an education X Prize. The X Prize being this prize that the incentive, which originally was the spacecraft land. But it's an enormously difficult issue because it's so systemic, so huge. How do you define what's an educated person? What are the metrics you use? How do you scale all those sorts of things?
Yeah. And the whole time scale of any kind of intervention is so long. You know, anyone who'd made a major contribution to education would be dead before you knew it.
But do you think beyond, obviously, I would assume you do, beyond the experimental work you do and the whole education system?
Mm. Well, I mean, I think... could claim, as it were, two avenues of interest to education. One is the fact that I'm an academic, so, you know, I'm an educator. That's my primary job, teaching, conveying knowledge to other people, which is what education is all about. But equally, you know, this interest in the brain and its plasticity and how it can be modified by experience should provide some, you know, insight into the educational process. I mean, here we are empirically, through schools and universities and so on, exploiting the capacity of brains to acquire knowledge. That's what education is. So you'd think that there could be a rational, and that means, you know, scientific evidence basis for educational theory, for how we set up our schools and our universities. It almost doesn't exist. I mean, there are educational theorists. There is a sort of, yeah, a discipline of educational studies. But it isn't solidly based on any kind of experimental or empirical framework, because it's so difficult to do experiments, of course. Mm-hmm. First of all, an experiment usually demands having some kind of control group or comparison group. Well, you know, if you think you're making an intervention, teaching in a different way, and you think it's beneficial, how are you entitled not to give that to anybody? It's the same kind of dilemmas as in running clinical trials. But that means, of course, then that some of the methodology for clinical trials could be incorporated into real experiments on education. That almost hasn't been done, and I think there's a huge opportunity there for science to impinge on an incredibly important area of real life, how we educate our kids. I mean, one of my interests in this, and this isn't novel, and it's recognised many years ago, is the possibility that the research on the early development of the brain, on the way in which the brain passes through sensitive periods in which it seems to be modified by experience, might be relevant to education. Now, I hesitate even to mention this because I think there's been the most ridiculous hype about the extrapolation between those results in education, all the Mozart effect stuff and the incredible emphasis on early years learning in babies. We should be teaching babies at the age of two and so on. It is a ridiculous leap from neurophysiological experiments on, let's say, kittens or mice to human babies, which is entirely unjustified. But, you know, it should be possible to discover whether the human brain goes through periods when it is optimally set up to learn certain things. I mean, we know for sure that's the case for language, not just first languages, but second languages. We know very well from the effects of brain damage, from the imaging studies and so on, that the brain is set up to acquire language between birth and, let's say, a maximum of 10 years of age. And that the whole, and you know it perfectly well, the way in which a child approaches the acquisition of normal language is completely different from the way that a 13-year-old in high school approaches it. The 13-year-old, you know, looks in books and learns the rules and memorizes the individual words. The baby just learns it. They just do it. So the brain passes through a sensitive period for language. What do we do when we organize language teaching in schools? Almost everywhere, at least in the US and the UK, we delay it until secondary school and teach it when the brain has gone through the sensitive period for acquiring it. And what do we do instead at early years? Well, in the UK, increasingly, we put an emphasis on formal learning of English, I mean, native language, and mathematics and things like that, with no evidence really that the brain is particularly set up to acquire mathematics, certainly not at the age of four or five. So an interesting report recently, and I'm afraid this is another, you know, example of a tension between the advisory system and government. A recent report from the Cambridge Institute, a big two-year study, came out with a very clear result, a long report offered to government, that Britain's current policy of introducing formal teaching in mathematics and English and so on from the age of four produces no measurable benefit at the age of eight or nine, compared with the many European countries, Hungary, I think, Switzerland, Germany, that begin formal teaching at the age of six or even seven. By 9 years of age, they've caught up with whatever British kids have got. So then it doesn't lead you just to criticize what's being done in British schools at the age of four, five, six, but to say, what else could have been done in those years which might have been more beneficial So we need to, I think, you know, we need a science of education, which is based on at least very good observation and preferably on clever experiments that would tell us about the optimal times to teach kids different things.
Actually, we would say a science of educating.
Yes.
Which is something that makes your point. Of course, Sarah Jane, your daughter, this is very much an area that she works in. Yeah. And my memory also is that you're involved with the Dana Foundation as well, which also has got a major thrust in this general direction.
Yes.
So, I have this lecture that you gave, this is something you gave me last time you were here, the Harveyan Oration in Celebration of Cerebration. You're about to give another lecture, the Ferrier Lecture, right, for the Royal Society?
Yes.
In which, in an email, you mentioned to me it would be you'd be doing a sort of a large theory of cortical development and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, yes, tentatively, you know, treading into the murky waters of human evolution.
Right. Is that an elaboration of this one, sort of?
Well, there'll be elements of the ideas in that. I mean, this was largely about, yes, cortical plasticity.
Yeah.
A review of cortical plasticity. And I've just been thinking a lot recently about the relevance of the plasticity of the brain, not just to the individual phenotype, you know, your behavior, your knowledge, the way you live, not just to social structures and culture and cultural transmission, but to the evolution of the brain. And I think the reason for thinking about this is because there's a real problem, which Darwin recognized very well, but he recognized it for an example where there was an easy explanation. He pointed out brilliantly in Origin of Species, this wonderful kind of set-up straw man, where he says, if you look at the eye, at the human eye, mm-hmm. Thinking that this might have been produced by this process I'm describing in this book of natural selection of, you know, small changes, just seems inconceivable. How on earth could, you know, such a complicated structure have been produced by small individual changes? Everything fits together so perfectly. All of it's needed, the lens and the retina and the shape, and anyway, all of it's needed for it to work properly. It's like the giraffe's neck, you know, a classical issue in evolution. But he brilliantly demolishes his own straw man by saying, no, it is possible, because all that's needed is that at each stage that there was a change, the structure as it was useful to the organism that had it. And you can see a way in which eyes will have developed from simple layers of photoreceptors in the skin surface, you know, gradually turning into a pit-shaped structure, then a sort of pinhole camera thing, and then a lens appearing. All of these primitive eyes in progression were valuable and adaptive to the organism that had them. So you can see the historical progression and the natural selection which produced each stage and eventually got to an incredibly complicated structure. The brain seems to me to be, a different kettle of neurons, if you like, because it is just such an enormously complicated structure. How on earth could, you know, tinkering with one part of it with a mutation have been, when the function of all of it depends on all of its connectivity to other specialized areas, how could each individual tinkering have been beneficial to the animal? So how does a little mutation here, which just changes one bit of the brain, one type of nerve cell or something, you know, have been sufficiently valuable and adaptive to the animal that happened to have that mutation for it to be preserved, and then other things in a coordinated way to be developed to set up what we finally see? So, you know, the particular example that I thought of, you know, pathways of nerves from the sense organs into the cerebral cortex, passing through several steps and different synapses and different structures, all of which are necessary for it to work. So was it all coordinated? A single mutation changing everything, that couldn't be possible. But I think there is a possible explanation, and that is that the inherent ability of the brain to respond to perturbations and changes inside it would have allowed small changes in one place to produce a phenotype that could be adaptive to the animal, and then to lay the the foundations for further subsequent changes to reinforce that beneficial change. So development in a mutation in one area might set up a system. The natural plasticity and ability to reorganize allows the animal to adapt to that change and therefore to make some use of it, and then to lay the groundwork for further subsequent random mutations to strengthen that change, that reorganization, to build the pathway as we subsequently see it. So the argument will be that the evolution of the human brain has been crucially dependent on the mechanisms of adaptability and plasticity in the brain. And that must be true for any very complex system to evolve.
Well, that's the underpinning that is a connectivist, constructivist view of the brain rather than a highly modularized view of the brain then.
Yeah, well, it's compatible with both, because but the modules are connected together. We can recognize modules in the cortex, for instance, different visual areas. And yes, during evolution, it's quite clear that during mammalian evolution, the brain's got bigger. Yes, the cerebral cortex particularly has got bigger, but it hasn't uniformly expanded. What's happened is it's added new computational modules. The whole damn thing, you know, a new visual area. The human brain probably has sort of 35 or so of these distinct recognizable processing areas. Monkeys, old world monkeys, might have 25. Mice, maybe have half a dozen. So these things have been added, and you can see why they are beneficial. You think, well, how on earth could that have happened? Because each of the areas is processing a different sort of information. Some of them even have their own inputs from particular specialized neurons in lower levels going down to the eyes. Now, how could that all have evolved? Seems to me it could only have evolved in a system which has sufficient adaptability in the individual to allow a change in one point to produce, through the inherent adaptability, a progressive change through the whole system, which can therefore be beneficial as a result of a small change and can lay the groundwork for subsequent evolutionary changes which reinforce that initial step. So that's the argument.
So this will be your sort of grand theory of the mind.
Yeah, and it's more than that, because I mean the other issue that's actually has puzzled me for a long time, and has puzzled other people too, but I've never seen a satisfactory explanation. We are, you know, genetically virtually indistinguishable from the first Homo sapiens sapiens. Very minor tinkerings and ethnic differences and with migrations, but you know, basically we're the same, and the brain was the same. And 4 times bigger than a chimpanzee brain. So the first Homo sapiens sapiens had a brain just as big as yours or mine, therefore presumably potentially capable of all the things that your brain's capable of doing. But, you know, living on the savannah in East Africa, yeah, doing some things that are pretty clever, but not that much cleverer than, say, chimpanzee groups, but having a brain 4 times as big. Now, you might say, well, as some people have argued, more than maybe society was a bit more complex, or perhaps they were slightly better hunters or something, and this gave them enough of an edge. But you have to remember, brains are unbelievably disadvantageous to animals in that they're hugely costly metabolically. Our brains consume something like 20% of the oxygen and the glucose in our blood. And actually, if you look at brain evolution in general, you see it as an effort to keep brains as small as is sufficient to support the behavioral requirements of that particular species. Yet here we are, or our predecessors were, ending up with this massive, hungry, demanding brain, not doing the things then that we are clearly capable of doing. I mean, to the extent that our lives are fuller, more intellectually demanding, richer, more full of knowledge, and so on, our culture is different from that of our Homo sapiens sapiens ancestors 100,000 years, can have nothing directly to do with genes, because we have the same genes. So everything that's happened in the last 100,000 years that makes us different from them cannot be directly a result of our genes. It is, of course, a result of our brains. But we didn't get our brains by natural selection in order to be able to do these things, because the forces of selection that were producing that big, hungry, expensive, you know, difficult organ to support were happening at a stage when it wasn't being used for all the things that it's now being used for.
You're saying it was early baggage?
It was baggage. But exactly, that's the essence of the idea. That the brain was not entirely functionless, but was a mutation, was a result of a mutation. And it's very easy to make things bigger. I mean, you know, to make a brain 4 times bigger just needs 2 extra cell divisions on average. Dead easy to make things too big. And there are lots of diseases where things are too big. Recent research shows you can make a mouse with a huge brain, with a variety of different mutations. And it gets all folded like a human brain as well. I don't know if it's more intelligent than a normal mouse, but you know what I mean. It's very easy to make a big brain, but in general, evolution hasn't made big brains because they're costly. So my hypothesis is that the human brain was a mistake. And it wasn't selected for because of advantages that it gave. It wasn't selected against because the disadvantage wasn't damaging enough.
I was going to say,
savanna of East Africa 100,000 years ago was a uniquely clement place to live. Resources, and I think the record shows this very well. Very few predators that couldn't be avoided by a reasonably sensible organism, didn't have to be an Einstein. Ready food supply, water in abundance, a very pleasant climate and all of those. It was just very easy living for early man. And the challenges made it less easy. The droughts, the changes in climate, vegetation, and so on that forced migration on our early ancestors were the very things that started to reveal the capacity of the brain to be adaptive. But that's tens of thousands of years after the brain as it was actually evolved. And as for the things that happened after agriculture, 20,000, 30,000 years ago, as for the things that happened after reading and writing, the discovery of the printing press, the invention of science, all of these things have happened with a brain which is basically a Stone Age brain, are there because of the capacities of our brains, which were evolved not as a result of them being capable of doing those things then. I think it was baggage.
So you're saying that the relatively clement environment
allowed this...
was not sufficiently demanding...
Yeah, to select against.
To select against this
nonsensically big brain. Yeah.
This expensive metabolic...
That's the argument I'll try and make.
Mm. Oh, well...
And so the... So the emerging potential of the brain, it's undeniable that that we are different users of our brains compared with previous human beings. Not more intelligent, that's very hard to assess, but different users of our brains, richer users of our brains. That can't be a result, basically, of our genetics. It's a result of a plasticity of our brain. So, let me give you a very specific example.
All right.
If you use these fMRI techniques to look at brain areas, you give people a job to do, looking at something or whatever, and a particular bit of the brain lights up, you say, aha, there's a module for recognizing color or movement or whatever. If you do it for spoken language, then, of course, you define the well-known areas in the brain, Broca's area, Wernicke's area, and so on, that light up when people are listening to language or speaking. Well, do it for written language. Give someone a word to read or a sentence to read. And you find, of course, you light up some of the basic language processing areas back here, Wernicke's area, but you also light up areas close to the visual areas, which seem to be concerned with analysing verbs and objects and people and so on. And they're related to areas that are processing visual images of objects, of processing movement of things in the visual world related to verbs and so on. It's as if the written language understanding system has been tacked on to the visuals, on appropriate bits of the visual system. That sort of makes sense. But just a minute. These are computational modules in our brains. You can see them in everybody who can read and write. But they couldn't have been there 4,000 years ago because people weren't reading and writing. Mm-hmm. So they have been, and this is not Lamarckianism. I'm not saying that these are things that could be inherited. If your offspring weren't exposed to reading and writing, they wouldn't have these areas. But there are areas which have been built in as a result of experience.
Yes, put this in very simple and possibly misleading terms, what you're talking about is having some cortical real estate, which is like a plot of vacant land because you might build on it.
Mm. Mm. Well, it's never vacant. It's never completely vacant, I think, except visual cortex of a blind person, which is vacant for a while, but not very long. So it's never vacant, but it's just used for different things. It's used on depending on the demands of the lifestyle of behavioural demands. So,
for instance, you're saying it's not doing much that it could. That it's,
well, maybe not doing it as efficiently. Not doing, you know, we have. If you looked at the brain of an educated person 100 years ago, I mean, I would suspect that large parts of the cortex would have been devoted to rote memory, great tracts of stuff that people were capable of remembering, probably much more than in the average kid today, to you know, simple mathematics, just kind of, you know, doing sums, because people required their brains to do it because they hadn't got pocket calculators, they hadn't got computers, they hadn't got all the storage devices that can assist us now. We have dumped a lot of that responsibility into technology. And subsequently, I mean, our brains are not as good at those things as people were 100 years ago. But that means we have more brain to do other things with. I mean, we, you know, the brain's just an amazingly mobile, changeable structure, which we can use to do a huge variety of different things. And if we can delegate some of the things that we used to use brains for to other things, to machinery, why not? It frees us to do more. I think we were nowhere near realizing the potential of the human brain. And of course, it's a great thing for science that we, that might, if that were true.
Have you run through any of this with your Oxford colleague, Richard Dawkins, who's...
I have indeed.
Because the greatest show
very
on earth.
Very recently, on the drive back from London last week, full of trepidation, you know, testing out ideas on people who really know about evolution. And I have to say, he didn't fault any of the ideas. You know, I think we have... For many reasons, we... are going to be forced to re-examine our whole notion of what genes are and what genes do, and hence our whole understanding of natural selection and evolution. And I say that not in any way as a critic of Darwinism. Let me be clear about that. But, you know, Darwin didn't know about genes, and yet, you know, developed a very convincing view of the basic process by which evolution could, natural selection could occur. And the discovery of genes, of course, led to all kinds of qualifications or dotting of I's and crossing of T's within Darwin's theory. Well, I think we're going to see continuing qualifications and expansion of this extraordinary idea that Darwin had, including discovering the ways in which natural selection isn't the explanation of everything. Epigenesis, which is very fashionable as an idea these days, is just one way that we're discovering that genes are modified in the individual, and what's more, in some cases, can even be transmitted as a basis of their modification to their offspring. I mean, real Lamarckism. But equally important, in fact, perhaps in some ways more important, the way in which the individual behavioural phenotype is dependent on the capacity of brains, their brains, to change. And in turn, those changes to be conveyed to others through learning, through education, through cultural transmission.
Yeah, you mentioned actually, since it is, we didn't quite finish that point I was making earlier, because I was actually saying, since I happen to have mentioned Time magazine, this cover, which is less than a month old, yes. Why Your DNA Isn't Your Destiny. This is about epigenetics. And we were talking earlier about the work of, you mentioned the work of David Barker and so on. There's some fairly remarkable findings come out in this area.
Yes. I mean, you refer to, you know, the Barker hypothesis, which was very controversial, but I mean, my feeling is having increasing influence, and what's more, you know, it fits with growing knowledge of mechanism. I mean, David, who was, by the way, you know, an MRC employee, he ran an MRC research unit in Southampton, an epidemiologist, discovered this extraordinarily high correlation between birth weight, just your weight at birth, and all kinds of subsequent medical problems, particularly heart disease initially. If you're a small baby, you have a higher chance of heart disease later on. But then it's extended to many, many, many more things. Metabolic disease and diabetes and so on, maybe even neurodegenerative conditions, a whole range of stuff that seems to be correlated with, who knows whether it's caused by, but correlated with birth weight. So it's as if the weight that a baby is, which is presumably to some extent determined by the intrauterine experience as their brain develops, sets them on a certain course, perhaps particularly in relation to their diet, the way in which they subsequently regulate their food intake and their food preferences, which sets them off in certain trajectories, which predispose them towards disease.
So in that case, the DNA almost is the destiny then.
Well, it could be. It could well be that this is due to epigenetic influences altering DNA in neurons and therefore changing the way in which the brain works. Yeah. Yeah. So certainly some of these examples of plasticity in the brain, the interaction between the brain and personal experience, will be due to direct modification of the DNA in those cells. Others, interesting, not necessarily through modulating the DNA itself, but changing the structure and the organization of nerve cells by working through pathways already established in the neuron as a result of genes that have been put there by evolution, have been selected by evolution because they give neurons the ability to change. And this, I mean, this is just my stupidity, but I think I shared the stupidity with a lot of other people. When I first started working in the area of brain plasticity, I thought very simplistically, okay, well, there are genes which make the structure of brains. And then there's the environment which comes along and, you know, changes the brain and makes it better, work better. But, you know, we know that genetics underpins everything. You can't kind of change things and reorganize them in useful ways without there being genes to allow it to happen, because genes make proteins, and proteins make cells and connections and all this stuff. So that leads to the conclusion, it took me 20 years to get there, there must be genes that allow you to be plastic. And there are masses of them, and my lab's worked on some of them, and people are discovering them all the time. So evolution has discovered, it's brilliant really, has discovered ways of making neurons that are, by virtue of their genetic mechanism, capable of learning from experience and changing themselves in ways that the genes themselves couldn't possibly have predicted. So genes have built in the ability to gain information beyond the informational limits of the genes. And of course that made better animals. Of course it's common sense, isn't it? You know, selection mechanism here. If you can make animals that aren't just stuck within the limits of what the genes program, but can actually acquire new things, you're going to make better animals. And that's the basis of plasticity.
So one of the things that you've done in terms of communication science was a series of columns for the Guardian newspaper in UK. And the topics we've spoken about, I sort of pulled out the column that you'd written on that, and just to see what kind of a response you got. And you did one which the headline writer entitled "A Necessary Evil," and this was about animal experimentation. Mm-hmm. And there were 99 comments came into the Guardian's website. There's another one here, again, headline writer agonizing about ecstasy, ho ho. And this one had 232 comments. This one is called "Science is Just One Gene Away from Defeating Religion," and 711 comments. And a lot of very irritated people who got moved by this discussion of creation, Darwin. Is that still a pretty... I'm a little bit surprised in the sense that I didn't think that issue would create... I can imagine it creating an issue in the United States, for example, but in UK, to trump these other two things.
Yeah, OK, well, you need to do the experiment. This is a series of articles which were written, you know, a year or two apart, probably. So maybe this trend towards blogging and Twittering and replying and commenting online has just increased and exploded during that period of time. So you can't make a straight assessment. You need the control experiment.
Well, the religion one was February 2009, obviously, because it was the bicentennial of Darwin.
Yes. And it was linked to a TV program as well. So it might be that a lot of the comment was triggered by the TV show that I presented.
That's right. Colin Blakemore's God and the Scientists is on Channel 4, etc.
Yes. But still, I must say, I'm very ambivalent about this development of the kind of blog world, and particularly commentary after newspaper articles. I don't read them. I find them so... I know I should, and go into a sort of endless iteration responding to every point, but I just find it so frustrating that people have the opportunity to pick out of context a single phrase or whatever and then expand their own pet hypothesis on the basis of it. I mean, so many comments that I have read seem to be almost deliberate misinterpretations of what's meant by the thrust of an article, so as to give people the opportunity to to exercise or to exhibit their own views. So it winds me up sometimes reading them, and that's not because I have a closed mind. I don't want to have a closed mind, but it is not. It's not an ideal way to engage in serious and proper consideration, debate, and discussion. These sort of snapshot vignettes based on someone's selected interpretation of what you've said, immortalized in print, I don't think is often a help okay. to real intercourse.
Fine. That said, I want to come back to the point, which is to ask you whether my sense of having visited the country on and off for many years, obviously, is that there might be. Yeah. What's the state of religion?
Well, at least 700 people who are worried enough to write a response. But that's not a big fraction of the population. That's the other thing. These things are so unrepresentative. You get, I don't know, maybe even 100, perhaps 1,000 people, a massive response, will write a comment on a newspaper article. In no way should that be taken as being representative of public opinion.
So, all right, let me be even.
I'm on a hobby horse here.
Let me be even more specific. Then.
Yes. Why do I? Am I not surprised in a secular country like the UK that an article about religion and science precipitated any concern? Is that
right.
what you're saying?
And when you have the new atheist Sam Harris, Dan Dennett, and of course Richard Dawkins, primarily with his new book and so on, and the
A.C. Grayling. It's a whole slew
and so on. Do you think that there's a reaction against that?
Well, of course there is.
Flushing out more people who would never have said they were religious before.
The
Templeton Foundation has been massing many campaigns.
I'm not sure it flushes out people who wouldn't previously have admitted that they were religious, but perhaps a few. But that's a good thing. I mean, this is an important area of debate, whether we like it or not and respect it or not. Religion has a huge influence on all of our lives. You know, yours and mine. We could be, victim of a terrorist bomb with religious motivation or whatever. You know, that religion is no longer a private practice. Right. Probably never was, but it's religion imposes itself on all of our lives. So we have the right, particularly those of us who are not religious, to express opinions about it. I'm not surprised that it produced, shall we call it, a healthy response, even in the UK, this terribly secular country that I live in. It does exercise.
Debate was generated.
Exactly. Exactly.
Is there any? I'm just curious. There's a question I was going to ask you before, in terms of, again, the trajectory of science. Is there any discovery that you looked at and thought, oh, my God, I wish I'd come up with that one?
Well, of course. I mean, everything that I haven't done that is fun, I'm like, oh, God, I wish I'd done that.
Because of its elegance and so on.
Yes, well, of course. I mean, I would love to have discovered what David Hubel and Torsten Wiesel discovered just a few years before I began in the same field. I mean, when I started this amazing discovery, for which they quite rightly won the Nobel Prize, about the way in which the visual system is so beautifully organized. I, as a graduate student, set up one of the certainly the first three or four labs in the world capable of doing that sort of work. I mean, entirely dependent on what they'd already found. But there was still the element of being close to being a pioneer. But sometimes a little bit frustrating to think that they did this just, just a few years earlier. What if I'd been there then? Would I have got there first? But that's silly.
But this whole process of how you make discoveries and the creativity process, I mean, I've talked to lots of people about this, and the S word gets used an awful lot, serendipity. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time when this thing came along and so on and so forth. The business of discovery just is very, it's really intriguing.
Yes, but then there are certain people who somehow happen to be in the right place at the right time time after time who make, you know, major contributions. You can't say, well, it can't all just be coincidence. So I think there really are genuinely more minds that are more creative than others in science as well as in art.
Yeah, and it's a
on the other hand, you know, a bit of help from fate doesn't do any harm.
It's the question of, it's the right, asking the right question, isn't it? I mean, Francis, you mentioned Francis Crick. He was so good at just, what is the right question to be asking?
Well, I would say, and it's heresy, that it's also knowing the right answer in advance.
Huh.
It's having the, you know, the clarity to predict. And it is respectable because it's making hypotheses. Francis Bacon wouldn't have liked it because he dismissed hypotheses as being useful in discovery. Don't start with a prejudiced mind. Let the facts inform you. But we know that's only part of the process. Science works more and more by guessing in advance how things are and then testing whether it's true or not. And I think that knack of seeing what's likely to be true is an extraordinary skill. And it's not just luck or chance. It comes from experience. Because if you've had enough experiences of discovering what's true, you begin to see patterns, how things should be. Perhaps more in biology than anything else. You begin to see, you know, sort of intuitively, what kinds of mechanisms nature will have arrived at by the natural selection process.